good morning. I'm going to call to order this Tuesday, December 13th, 2016 meeting of the Senate Interim Committee on Workforce. Welcome, everyone. This is our December legislative days, and we have a number of very interesting issues to learn about today, some of which are going to find their way into the 2017 session, either directly or indirectly through various policy and budget asks. So, and then towards the end of the meeting, we'll also have a work session to introduce committee bills. We have a number of bills to introduce to remind us that, yes, the 2017 session is coming. So we're going to start with a report from the Women's Foundation of Oregon. They recently completed a report on the status of women in Oregon called Count Her In. And I'm going to ask Emily Evans to come up and present us that report and some of the highlights, particularly with respect to the situation of women in the workplace, in the workforce here in Oregon. Emily, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Dembrough and the rest of the members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. For the record, my name's Emily Evans. I'm the Executive Director of the Women's Foundation of Oregon. Let me start with an apology that there's only two full copies of the report up there. This is our second printing, and you have the two remaining copies. Your colleagues on the House side snatched the last of the ones that were supposed to be for the rest of the committee, but you each have the executive summary, and each of your offices received a full copy of the report in September. Want to also thank in particular, Senator Gilzer, for giving some early feedback on the report before when it was still in rough PowerPoint form last spring. So I'll start with a little bit of background. You can see on the back of the report how we made it on the back, and the two most germane things to take are probably that Echo Northwest, our colleagues there, did all of the data and the number crunching for us, and that we did a 3,000-mile, 14-stop listening tour to hear from 1,000 women and girls across the state, and their voices and stories and experiences are on every page. So I'll just do a few of the basics about the report itself. We'll do our eight to celebrate and our eight that can't wait, because everybody loves a rhyme. And then we'll talk a little bit about the local data, and then in particular spend some time talking about the workforce issues that are highlighted by the report, and then give some time for Q&A. So the report is Count Her In, and for context, it's the first comprehensive report on the status of women and girls in Oregon in just about 20 years. The last report was in 1998, and most of the data from that report was from the 1990 census. And here are our listening tour stops all over the state. We hitched up my grandparents' 1985 RV and used it as our listening tour bus. And we had sessions in Spanish and Russian and Somali. We had sessions out at the Umatilla Reservation and in Burns and in Bend, really all over the state. So this is some additional context. So this is what I looked like the last time we had fresh data on women and girls in Oregon. I'm wearing a very similar outfit, which I find embarrassing, but for additional context, the Berlin Wall had just come down, Ronald Reagan had just left office, pretty much no one had a home computer. I assume that you all looked exactly the same, but it was a different era, and we've gone for essentially a generation in a data blind about 51% of the state, and that's what this report attempts to rectify. So if you take nothing else from this report, take away this sentence: Oregon women and girls are giving more but getting less than women and girls in most other states. We have started with the positive part of that discussion, Senator, with what we're calling eight to celebrate. So I'll go over them briefly, highlighting a couple of the key areas where Oregon women and girls are making the state really strong and livable. They vote at higher rates than Oregon men and than women in most other states. They perform just a ton of unpaid caregiving. The unpaid doesn't really deserve celebration, but many, many millions of hours each year of unpaid caregiving. Fewer than 5% of the violent crimes in Oregon are committed by women and girls. Oregon women and girls engage in the most daily physical activity than women and girls in any other state. I always like to point out that I think Colorado thinks they're number one, but they're not. We are. And then in education and healthcare, women comprise 70% of our public school teachers and 80% of the state's healthcare workers. Oregon women and girls are incredibly generous with their money and time. Oregon women serve in statewide elected office at some of the highest rates in the country, as we can see here on this committee, which is pretty extraordinary. And Oregon girls met the state's goal for 2025 college graduation rates in 2014, 11 years ahead of schedule. So on the flip side of that is the giving more but getting less. Put a different way, Oregon women and girls are contributing every day in a ton of ways that make our communities vibrant and wonderful. And on the flip side, they are experiencing some of the starkest gender inequities in the country. And we've laid them out here in what we're calling the 8 that can't wait. The first is violence against women. Oregon has pretty alarming rates of violence against women, one of the highest in the country. The current estimation is that 1 million women and girls in Oregon, over half the state's female population, have experienced some form of sexual or domestic violence. And in terms of service provision, we know that 10,000 calls for domestic violence shelter went unanswered in 2014 for lack of resources. So not only do we have much higher rates than other states, we have very insufficient capacity to help support survivors. Next, we have systemic racism, and we see this all throughout the data, that women and girls of color experience additional barriers because they live at that intersection of both racism and sexism. And we see that in employment numbers, poverty rates, educational attainment, and leadership. The next is the cost of caregiving. Oregon is among the least affordable states in the nation for childcare. It's now more expensive to send your toddler to childcare for a year than it is to send your kid to U of O for a year. And we are only seeing that getting worse as the cost of living continues to increase while wages are relatively stagnant. Next are barriers to reproductive health. Oregon has a long history of protecting reproductive rights, which is wonderful and should be celebrated, but the data tell us that rights are not access and that access is not utilization. And we see that the number of unplanned pregnancies in Oregon has remained virtually the same for the past 20 years. Just below half of every pregnancy in Oregon each year is unplanned. Next, we get into a couple that are particularly germane to this committee, the wage and wealth gap. We see the wage gap that spreads from 53 cents on the dollar for Latino women up through 83 cents on the dollar for white women here in Oregon, which is pretty remarkable, but also somewhat on par with the rest of the nation. Where we see a huge difference between Oregon and the rest of the country is the resultant wealth gap. Oregon has one of the biggest wealth gaps in the country, meaning a sum total of a person's assets. So Oregon women hold only about 35 cents in wealth compared to what each dollar in wealth held by Oregon men. And this then contributes to what we're calling economic fragility, which is essentially a poverty number, but it's important to convey the precarity that so many Oregon families are experiencing, the vast majority of them headed by women, such that even an unexpected expense of $100 or $200, you know, a flat tire or an emergency trip to the dentist, will throw a family into financial chaos without having to borrow money or sell something. Next, we have mental health. This was probably, I think, the sleeper issue when we went to communities. Every single community we went to identified mental health as one of the top three concerns, and the data really bear that out. We have the highest rates of reported depression for women in the country. Twice as many women attempt suicide than men in Oregon each year. We have higher than average adverse childhood experience scores and a high number of women reporting at least one poor day of mental health per month. And finally, the public-private glass ceiling. We only have one woman CEO of a publicly traded company here in Oregon, and our corporate boards are of those publicly traded companies are less than 17% women. We also see that and the public sector, even though we have much better representation than most states, we're still not near reflective leadership either in the state house and especially at the county level. There are four counties that have no women in countywide elected leadership whatsoever. So together, the thing that I guess to stress about these is that they really interact as a system. We heard that over and over again on the tour, and you see it borne out in the data, that it's pretty much impossible to slice one of these off and deal with it in isolation. They're locked in kind of a constant series of cause and effect with one another, and together they interact to create a system of daily challenges for Oregon's women and girls. And I know this is a kind of a stark realization for many folks. For years, we heard that Oregon didn't really have a problem with gender equity, but we think that the data make very clear that with these eight together, comprising among some of the worst data in the nation, that, Oregon does have a deep problem with gender equity. One important thing to note about the report is that for the first time, we have local data. Every county on the back of the report, you'll see, has a county-level dashboard. This one is for Jackson County that has the wage gap by county, the labor force participation rates by county, the women's leadership rate by county, so that we're able to drill down to the sub-state level and give local leaders and for you all information about areas in your districts that that give kind of a report card on how women and girls are doing. And then we also include five things every Oregonian can do and five things leaders, Oregon leaders can do. It's pretty stark data, but we want to stress that there are things to be done. These are not problems that are insoluble. They are difficult and they are tractable, and we've seen many of them be stagnant for the last several years, but we also know that there are answers. And these five things every Oregonian can do and every Oregon leader can do, starting with things like demanding better data. We should never go for 20 years again without a report like this on half the state, is where we think we can start. So a couple of workforce issues that I'd love to highlight and then take a few questions. The first is caregiving-related barriers to labor force participation. I know this is of real concern to this committee. So Oregon has, for women, a pretty low rate of labor force participation. We have many big swaths of the state where fewer than 50% of, the women are participating in the labor force. And for us, every family and every individual gets to make their own decision about when and how they participate in the labor force, and that's really a personal concern. But what we heard on the tour and what we see in the data is that there are massive barriers to participation in the labor force, largely related to caregiving. Over a third of the women we spoke to while out on tour said that a lack of affordable, high-quality, accessible childcare had been a major barrier for their participation in the workforce. So when you think of 36% of the state experiencing barriers, that's a huge part of the economy and the workforce that are simply not participating, willing to participate and ready, but not able to because of the barriers that are related to their gender, which is of deep concern. The next is the wage gap. Colleagues, including Senator Rosenbaum, testified yesterday in the House Business and Labor Committee specifically about Oregon's wage gap. And the important thing I think to note there is that there are things that we can do related specifically to workplace discrimination, which is important. But the wage gap is made up of kind of a toxic stew of additional things, including barriers related to caregiving, structural disadvantages that are given to women in the workplace, and the fundamental devaluation of women's work, areas where women have traditionally clustered, that for some reason we just decide are worth paying less, even though they have a comparable set of skills, education, and risk to more traditionally male-dominated fields. So it will take action both in terms of a fair pay, getting rid of discrimination in the workplace, but also structural changes that need to take place if we're going to truly eliminate the wage gap. We also see the wealth and retirement gap. The wage gap compounds over years and eventually over generations to create a serious wealth gap. Homeownership rates by single female-headed households in Oregon is one of the worst in the state. And then we see that flow all the way through to the retirement gap, where women end up having just a fraction of what most Oregon men have into retirement. And I want to commend the legislature for the Oregon retirement system work that's been done. I think it's an important step in addressing some of the retirement gaps that we see. The next is EITC underutilization, which I also know is of deep concern to this committee. So it's been long known for a while that the EITC, or the Earned Income Tax Credit, here in Oregon, we have the lowest utilization in the country. We're dead last, 50 out of 50. Only 73% of the folks who are eligible are utilizing it. And for the first time that we're aware of, this report actually breaks it out by county. The potential additional EITC dollars if participation increased by 10% in a given county. So, for instance, in Multnomah County, we'd be drawing down $5.5 million each year into the pockets of some of the most vulnerable families who need it most if we increased EITC participation by just 10%. And the reason this is an important issue to look at by gender is that 55% of EITC recipients are women, single women with children, and another 25% are married women. So if we don't look at EITC with a gender lens, we're missing 75% of the recipients of EITC. I'd like to end by flagging a few additional opportunities for both learning and discussion. You each have a little flyer that outlines the upcoming Eight the Can't Wait discussion series, where we're going to dive into these issues a bit more. They'll be in Portland, but we're also live casting them on Facebook. And if you're staff or you would like to attend, we're going to dive much deeper into some of these issues, root causes, and potential solutions throughout the spring. We're also releasing a companion report later in January on state policies that work for women that seem to be working well in other states that have much better outcomes than we do, particularly related to the Eight That Can't Wait, to kind of give some additional context and an imperative for action where Oregon really needs to make progress if we're going to turn the wheel on many of the Eight That Can't Wait. And then finally, the Women's Foundation is eager to help be a thought partner and continue to provide information and support for things that that legislators would like to do to make Oregon a great place for women and girls. I'd love to answer some questions.
I'll start off, Emily. I really appreciate that the report drills into this at the county level. And I'm just wondering what sort of patterns you're seeing around the state, in terms of, we often talk about the urban-rural divide, mm-hmm. right? So do you see, urban versus rural patterns? I realize many of the counties include both urban centers and rural, but is there, are there conclusions that can be drawn, some patterns that you see?
I think so. I think one of the biggest takeaways actually is that, as I mentioned, we went 3,000 miles across the state and we were in all different kinds of areas, and the Eight That Can't Wait were things that rose to the top no matter where we were. If we were with ranchers in Burns, or we were with tribal populations in Umatilla, or we were on the coast in Newport, or in Southern Oregon, or in North Portland, these eight really rose to the top pretty much no matter where we were, which was really interesting to me. And they were very synonymous with what the data were saying. So the presenting issues in almost every community really lined up with what the data were saying, which told us that Oregon women and girls kind of know exactly what's wrong. You see, I think, some barriers. I think the biggest differences that we saw were in more rural areas that their access to services were kind of a larger issue, that there simply weren't enough childcare facilities, or there were no mental health providers, or there were no violence against women shelters to be found, versus in the more urban areas, I'd say we saw more cost-related barriers. That the barriers were largely due to things just being unaffordable and the cost of living going up rapidly. But overall, I would say that a lot more unites the experience of women in Oregon than divides them. And these concerns about caregiving and the wage and wealth gap and mental health really transcend the urban-rural divide.
Questions, Alex? Well, I do have one more, and that is, so this is full of kind of quantitative analysis, and in terms of qualitative, as you're looking at, the causes, what are some of the causes of these effects that you're seeing?
I think it's a good question. One of the things that we went on the road to kind of discover and probe a little bit in communities are what are some of the root causes. And what we came back with was really also undergirded by the data is the sense that it's truly systemic. This infographic is meant to be quite literal in the sense that it's a web of challenges. When you see numbers like 50% of the state experiencing violence against women, or a third of the women we speak to unable to participate in the workforce because of caregiving, that's not anything that any individual can be held culpable for. I think we have a lot of mythology around, it's individual choices that dictate these things. But when you're seeing a huge number of Oregon's women and girls facing these barriers every single day. That's something we must address as a state on a systemic level through policy change and cultural change, because it's not a matter of, you know, half the state just happens to be making decisions that are leading to these outcomes. It's really is systemic, and I commend this committee and the legislature for taking on many of these issues, and I have a lot of confidence that you'll continue to bring that systems mindset, because that's really what's needed at the root, I think.
And Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Emily, it's great to get a look at this. Every time I look at it, I see new stuff. But I wanted to ask you about the low rate of participation by women in the workforce, and to what extent are women having to drop out and drop back into the workforce? And I haven't had a chance to read that section in detail, but it certainly is the case that a lot of women are not only taking care of children, but taking care of elderly parents or other family members. And I think we all have experienced in our own lives times where somebody needs us to be there, and if we're fortunate, we're able to adjust our work schedule so we can do that. But for a lot of people, they can't do that and sometimes end up getting fired or quitting jobs as a result of having to be gone. So is that a pattern that you saw in what you looked at?
We saw it over and over and over again. Countless stories about having to enter and exit the workforce because of caregiving responsibilities, whether that be because they have three kids under the age of five and they simply can't afford to keep three kids in childcare and also work a relatively low-wage job, or having to drop out to take care of elderly parents who are suffering or potentially living with them. One of the most insidious things that we see is that we know that when women take substantial time out of their workforce for caregiving, they almost never get back on track with salary growth or career projections. There's no way in the trajectory of a life to get back to where one was. So it's not as if you just hit pause and then you come right back in where you were. And one of the other things that we see as deeply insidious in that cycle is that when a family is evaluating who is going to take time off for caregiving, often, you know, traditionally and culturally, it's women, but they often also look at the partner who's making less. So the wage gap in the first place is often producing women who are earning less than their male partners, but then they are the ones that have to drop out continuously because they're making less, which just increases that cycle over and over and over again, which is, I think, a testament to this sort of systemic problem that must be addressed before we're able to make progress on things like the wage gap.
And a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. So I know a number of states have family leave insurance programs. That's contemplated in Oregon, too. Do you think that would go very far to remedy the participation rate in the workforce?
I'll be frank with you, Senator. I can't think of a single policy that the legislature could move in 2017 that would have more of an impact on the economic well-being of Oregon women and girls than paid family leave. It's clear in the data, it's clear in other states, it's clear across the world, and it's clear from women and girls we heard in every community, whether that's women in transitional programs in Southern Oregon, ranchers out in Burns, women who are agricultural workers out in Ontario, across the state, it would have a massive impact on the economic well-being of women and girls.
Thank you.
Thank you. you know, in terms of the wage gap, you know, within similar occupations. You know, I mean, there's the other issue of different occupations, which are dominated by women, tend to be undervalued and paid less. And let's hold off on that for a moment. But within those occupations where we have both men and women working and women are earning less than men, are there particular occupations that you can pinpoint where that's a problem?
Where we're seeing a great deal of it. You know, I think what we see with the wage gap is at lower paying jobs, there's just less differentiation in general, because when you're at the bottom, you're at the bottom, and the wage gap we know actually increases with educational attainment and salary. So there's no way for women to essentially educate or career their way out of the problem. But what we're seeing is, I think there's this sort of incoming, all right, you know, you young man get your starting salary of $35,000 a year, and I'm offering this young woman $32,000 a year, or what have you, that sort of outright discrimination. But we're also seeing kind of more insidious, I would say, wage gap elements. For instance, we heard yesterday the testimony of a woman who had worked both in the canneries and in hotel housekeeping in Astoria. And in those scenarios, women of color, particularly Latino women, were just expected for the same wages and the same amount of hours worked and, to produce a huge amount more, to clean twice as many hotel rooms or to fill twice as many cans within a given chunk of time. So I think we're also seeing really structural differences that are less like overt discrimination and more differing expectations and expectations that are contributing to both the wage gap and the inability to grow or compete or ascend in a particular field.
And in terms of the differences between occupations, well, first of all, let me say that no matter who's doing what work, they need to be fairly paid, and ideally they need to be earning a living wage. But, you know, this committee has also been interested in moving more women into the CTE and STEM kinds of occupations at the, you know, the middle skills, the skilled trades, and the STEM engineering kinds of trades. And that, too, you know, I think just requires concerted effort, ongoing, and, you know, it's slow, but it's, you know, it requires constant attention, I think. And I don't know, do you have any thoughts about that?
I think it's deeply important. I think breaking down barriers to any type of occupation by a gender that we've had and have been very traditional is a wonderful thing. I also think we know that the data say that when women enter a field en masse, that the wages tend to go down. So the more a field becomes aligned with a sort of women's work perspective, the more the wages depress. Madeleine Albright once said that she was worried that was going to happen to the Secretary of State's pay after there had been a number of women Secretary of State. So happens even at the highest levels. So I think it's extraordinarily important to break down those barriers, but we also know that that just getting all women or girls into STEM fields won't solve the problem because it will eventually depress the wages in those fields until we have a fundamental rethinking about what women's work is worth.
Okay, thank you very much, Emily, for this.
Thank you.
Okay, our next topic is about the problem within the workplace having to do with bullying, where employees feel vulnerable to bullying from colleagues or from peers or from managers. And we have a panel of people to talk about this under the rubric of healthy workplaces. So I'm going to ask Lisa Stein, please, and who's on the phone?
Dr. Balserzak.
Okay, Dr. Balserzak's on the phone. Susie Brenton and Janet Shattuck. Is that
right? I thought you might have a panel of Republicans come up. Feel bullied by the majority.
Come on, we're so kind to you guys. Okay, welcome all. So, Lisa, are you going to start it off?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so if you could just introduce yourself for the record, just by name, and tell us a little about this problem, kind of frame it for us, and then we'll get into the details.
Very good. Good morning. For the record, my name is Lisa Stein. Let me thank Senator Dembro and the members of the Senate Interim
and
Workforce.
For the record, I'm Dr. Judith Balserzak.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let me thank the members of the Workforce Committee for having us here this morning to speak about the problem of abusive work environments. I'm here today.
Stand here, Lisa. I'm sorry.
Okay. I will speak up as clearly as I can. Is that better?
That's better.
Okay. I am here today as a concerned Oregonian and also as a member of the National Association of Social Workers, the Oregon chapter, which supports taking legislative action to address the issue of abusive work environments. My roots in Oregon are deep, My maternal great-grandparents are buried on a hillside in Grants Pass overlooking I-5. I majored in business administration and psychology in college, after which I earned a master's in social work from Indiana University in May of 1980. 2 weeks after graduation, my husband and I crossed the Oregon Trail in a U-Haul and arrived in Eugene, where my husband taught for 2 years while he was earning his master's. Over the past 40 years, I have worked in a variety of industries: healthcare, higher education, corporate accounting, manufacturing, and nonprofits, including social services, where I spent 32 years working with young people and their families. After concluding my career in the spring of last year, I had the gift of time to reflect on the experience of the past four decades and to listen to stories of family, friends, and former coworkers about their lives and livelihood. By the end of 2015, I was overwhelmed by the tales I was hearing for the first time from people dear to me who had or were suffering as a consequence of functioning in an abusive work environment. I wrote out the list. More than 20 individuals in my network alone had experienced patterns of abusive behavior intended to intimidate, offend, or create hostility within the workplace. From the list, the people demonstrating these destructive behaviors represented a variety of professions, including engineers, bankers, architects, dentists, doctors, lawyers, pastors, educators at all levels, including tenured faculty, public safety officers, and public employees. The settings crossed a variety of industries, including for-profits and nonprofits, union and non-union, big businesses and small shops. The data jumped off the page. And my list of storytellers was just as diverse: highly educated professionals, folks in entry-level jobs, seasoned employees, people at the outset of their careers. More importantly, the abusive patterns were impacting people across such categories as race, gender, age, disability. The problem was occurring regardless of status. I was appalled by the fallout I was seeing in people's lives and began to wonder what could be done. In January of this year, I began to research the issue of abusive work environments. The journey of discovery led me to Dr. Judith Balzerzak's newly released book on the topic, and I'm thrilled you'll be able to hear her testimony in a few moments. Through this year, my list has grown. Those of us on the panel today offer you a glimpse of the breadth and depth of this problem. I would be remiss if I did not mention that there are others who would have been here today but could not testify, either for fear of retaliation or because they have been forced to sign non-disclosure agreements in order to salvage what is left of their livelihoods. The idea of abusive work environments is not new. Employment practices that encourage healthy workplace interactions and management have been the standard of best practice for years. Yet the problem persists and is in fact escalating. Oregon needs a clear definition of what an abusive work environment is and is not. We need the means to protect employees and employers from the crisis and costs that are occurred when this type of pattern destructive behavior is present. In closing, a story from the beginning of my career. On a Monday afternoon in February 1976, three Indiana University publicity staff members and a student intern were together in the office they shared. They were feverishly preparing for a basketball game that evening. Believing that he had been misquoted after Saturday's game by one of the publicists, the 6'5" head basketball coach stormed into the office and began verbally abusing that staff member. Not satisfied with his attack on the 5'8" man, the coach initiated a physical altercation. At this point, the head of the office, a World War II Navy fighter pilot, step between the coach and the man and stop the onslaught. The coach left the office. The former pilot went directly to the athletic director. The next afternoon, when all four staff members were assembled again, they were told by the former pilot that the incident from the day before had officially, quote, never happened. The coach was Bobby Knight. The student intern who witnessed the incident told me the story in the fall of 1976 when I began working as a stat crew member for IU basketball. The intern was worried I might inadvertently trigger Coach Knight and wanted to try to protect me, as he knew the incident he had witnessed was only one instance of a much larger pattern of abuse. That student intern became my husband in 1978, and the sad truth is that there is very little that he, nor I, nor anyone in this room can do even now, 40 years later, to protect ourselves or our coworkers from this type of abusive behavior in the workplace. Before I introduce Dr. Balzerzak, are there any questions for me at this time?
Actually, I think we'll hold questions till the end.
That's great. Let me have the honor then of introducing Dr. Judith Balzerzak. Judith has worked as a clinical social worker for over 35 years. Licensed in California since 1981, she has spent decades working in healthcare in the public and private sectors. Dr. Balzerzak teaches in the Family and Marriage Therapy Master's Degree Program at California Lutheran University in Thousand Oaks. She also teaches in the psychology and sociology departments at Ventura College and has extensive experience in both clinical and consulting practice. Judith brings not only a wealth of professional experience, but a wealth of knowledge as a result of the research for her book titled Workplace Bullying, Clinical and Organizational Perspectives, which was published by National Association of Social Workers in December of 2015. Dr. Balzerzak, thank you for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you for inviting me to share. Please remind me how long I have to talk this morning.
20
minutes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, really 20 minutes for the entire panel.
Great, yes. Thank you. Go ahead and advance to slide 2 and then on to slide 3 of my presentation. Thank you again for inviting me to comment on the issue of workplace bullying. In terms of an historical perspective, the research on workplace bullying actually has been going on in Scandinavia and Western Europe and the United Kingdom and Australia for a couple of decades. And believe it or not, the United States is very far behind most of the developed world in terms of not only studying this very relevant topic, but also providing protection for workers who are being harmed in the workplace. So the grandfather of our modern concept of workplace bullying was a gentleman named Heinz Lehmann, who was an industrial psychologist from Sweden, practicing in Germany, and he defined workplace bullying as an emotional assault that starts when an individual becomes a target of disrespectful and harmful communication and behavior in the workplace. Next slide, please. So bullying is really aggression against a person. It is not the same thing as discrimination. We know that discrimination is expressly prohibited in not only our Civil Rights Act, but also the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so people cannot be discriminated against based on their age or their gender, or their race or ethnicity or creed or nationality or disability or pregnancy or sexual orientation. In addition to the fact that the behavior is abusive, I think it's very important to focus on the, next slide please, the frequency and duration of the emotional abuse. So this is not the same as an occasional prank or a practical joke or even a rude comment. When we talk about workplace bullying, we're really talking about something that's much more severe and much more pervasive. Next slide, please. So it usually occurs as a process, not an event, and it oftentimes starts when there's an issue of conflict in the work environment that goes unresolved. The conflict escalates into abusive behavior that can be terrorizing, and the person who's being targeted begins to feel increasingly helpless. They begin to have symptoms of individual distress that are both physical and emotional symptoms. The productivity not only of the target, but the rest of the workforce can really suffer. And unfortunately, the person who's a target is, because they're experiencing daily torment, they start using more and more of their sick leave time or annual leave time in order to try to recover. And far too often, resignation prematurely or termination or early retirement occur as an outcome. And for the target, in very, very extreme cases, the person can die. It may be through a very serious illness, like a severe heart attack or a stroke, or in some instances, people may take their own lives because they're feeling so desperate and demoralized. Next slide, please. So the key features, it occurs over a period of time. It's a continual process, and it portrays the target or the victim as being at fault. It's engineered to discredit the person, intimidate the person, isolate that person, maybe force that person out of the workplace. And if the target leaves the workplace through termination or early retirement, it's almost always represented as the target leaving by choice. And next slide, please. And unfortunately, as Lisa suggested, it's often ignored or misrepresented or tolerated or endorsed or even encouraged or instigated by administrators or management in an organization. Next slide, please. So I'm going to talk really quickly about the five different categories of bullying so that we can be very clear about what it is that we're referring to. The first category involves, this would be slide 10, involves behaviors that impact the person's ability to express himself or herself at work and the way that communication happens in the workplace. And so the person might be, you know, constantly interrupted in meetings or scolded or yelled at publicly. They may be constantly criticized. They might be terrorized on the phone. They can be receiving written threats or oral threats. And even ongoing behaviors like, you know, looks or innuendos, like eye rolling every time the person speaks in a meeting, those could be considered self-expression kinds of examples. Next slide. Pardon me. The second category is when the target gets socially isolated. So people don't talk to that person. The person's not allowed to talk to anyone else. The target might be put in a workspace that's very isolated from other people. And I'll recall from the very popular TV series that ran for so many seasons, West Wing, there was an episode in which President Bartlet had hired a woman who was an expert in environmental protection issues. She happened to be of a different political party than the administration. And President Bartlet told his staffers to, you know, find her an office and make sure she had a desk and a computer and a phone. And so they located her in a abandoned storage room, a 10 by 10 cement block room in the bowels of the White House. And the had to walk through acres and acres of file cabinets and storage units to get to this little cement block room where she was, you know, housed to do her work. Of course, that got resolved by the time the episode was over, and that's a really extreme example, but that's the kind of thing that we're talking about when we talk about social isolation. The third category includes attacks on the person's reputation. There might be negative gossip or unfounded rumors. The person might be ridiculed. They might be forced to undergo a psychiatric evaluation. They might be mocked for their religious beliefs or their political beliefs, or they might be forced to do work, next slide please, that affects their self-esteem. Any of their efforts to try to do well are judged to be wrong, and the person is being constantly demeaned. And this can include name-calling and sexual innuendos. So that, next slide, please. And the fourth category really is attacking the person's quality of professional life, in which either the person's job description shrinks so that they have no assignments at all, or they're given meaningless jobs to carry out, or they're restricted to doing tasks that are way below their qualifications level. Next slide. And it can also mean that they're given new tasks that demean their self-esteem, or things like damage to the person's workstation or home might even occur. Number 16, would be direct attacks on a person's health. The person might be forced to do work that's physically strenuous and beyond their physical capabilities. They might be threatened with physical violence. They might actually use light violence as a threat. There can be outright sexual harassment. And a great example of the fifth category would be from the very, very significant film that was done several years ago called North Country. It was about women entering the coal mining industry in northern Minnesota. If you haven't seen that one, it's really, really worth watching. Okay, so five different types of bullying. Are these things legal? Well, guess what? In the United States, in every state in the union, the third category and the fifth category are illegal, and they're specifically covered by law. On the other hand, most of the first and the second and the fourth categories fall into the role of being the employer's prerogative. So we don't really have good workplace protections for those kinds of behaviors. Next slide. So let's look at what happens to the person who's being targeted. And I think Lisa did a really fine job of talking about some of her observations, some of the stories that she heard from people in her network and in her life. And these are going to vary in intensity and duration. Next slide. In the first stage, and this is actually what happens in this stage is considered to be a good outcome. The person might be able to resist what's going on. They can escape early, or they might have resolution of the situation, and they might be fully rehabilitated in that same work environment. Sometimes another good outcome would be the person retains their job, but they're moved to another location so that they don't have the situation occurring in that new locale. Next slide. In the second stage, the person can't resist or immediately escape. And I think it's obvious that many, many reasons that people can't just walk away from employment. They, you know, their income is supporting a family. They may be the provider of health care benefits for their family members. And in this second stage of responding, the target is going to suffer some temporary or even prolonged level of disability. It can be psychiatric or can be physical. And they may have a period of medical leave, and returning to the workplace might be very difficult for them. And that could result in their being chronically unemployed or chronically depressed or anxious. If the person's able to return to work after having this degree of harm, it's still considered to be a somewhat good outcome. You know, we want people to be able to go back to work, so if this happens, that's considered to be a good thing. Next slide, slide number 21. In stage three, and Lisa, maybe you have experienced this with some of the people you were describing. In stage three, the person becomes disabled and they're not able to go back to work. And physical or psychiatric rehabilitation is not going to be very likely unless a specialized treatment protocol is utilized. Next slide. I think before we talk about how common this is, when you think about what could happen when a person has a prolonged period of disability and then can't go back to work, that's when this person may become a public sector responsibility. They may need, you know, to go on public assistance of some sort. They may need publicly funded medical health care benefits, et cetera. Slide number 22, so how common is this? I think one of the things we're recognizing in this domain is that very much like family violence and intimate partner violence, it's very difficult for us to get clear numbers about how severe the problem is, what's the incidence and prevalence. Some reasons for that, next slide. And this is very, very horribly underreported and misunderstood. People who have been targeted generally feel very ashamed and very embarrassed. Like Lisa suggested, they may have a settlement agreement that actually prevents them from talking about it or completing any kind of a research survey or participating in any data collection. Next slide. But what we think we know, and this comes from the work of Dr. Gary Naumi of the Workplace Bullying Institute in Washington, we think there's about a 20% lifetime prevalence. So about one in five workers may be targeted over the course of their work histories. At any moment in time, and this figure comes from Heinz Lehmann, as I said, the early pioneer, I think this number happens to be low, but using a 4% incidence at any moment in time, that there would be 4% of the population that's being bullied at work, is probably a very conservative estimate. So I think it's okay for us to use that kind of a figure when we think about how severe, how pervasive, how many people are going to be impacted. Next slide. So these numbers come from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the United States Workforce, and this was October of 2016. So these are very, very current figures. The labor force in October was 159 million. Of that number, almost 152 million people were employed, leaving an unemployment rate for the nation of just under 8 million. About 4.9%. So if we take 4% of that number, that means at any moment in time, there could be 6 million people, 6 million workers in the United States who are being bullied, which is a travesty. Next slide. And as many as, if we use a 20% estimate, as many as 30 million people will experience being targeted over the course of their work life. Next slide. So I was interested in what was happening in Oregon in terms of the workforce size and employment rates, et cetera. In October, Oregon had just over 2 million people in the workforce and an unemployment rate a little bit higher than national figures, about 5.3%, or a little over 100,000 people not working. And then the BLS teases out non-farm workers, so we always have, especially in western and southern states, always have some farm workers. So we have 1.8 million workers who are not involved in agriculture. I pulled the health and education data and government data just because those tend to be kind of high-risk environments, to be very honest. So 273 million Oregon workers working in health and education in October, and over 300,000, 273,000, I apologize, and over 300,000 working in the government public sector. Okay, next slide. So if we looked at 4% of Oregon's employed workforce, that would be almost 79,000 employees being bullied at any moment in time, and almost 400,000 Oregon workers might be bullied over the course of their work history. Very, very difficult for us to gather data. Next slide, number 30. You know, figures are vastly underreported. People are fearful or they might be legally prohibited from talking about their experience. Many times it's not recognized as being something that's, you know, to discuss. So people aren't always clear about what workplace bullying is, and so there's no one to tell. And again, that's like family violence. The targets don't always take action that gets attention. And from a research perspective, and I teach research in a graduate program at California Lutheran University, we really are only describing what people are self-reporting, so that's not the same as being able to establish a clear kind of causal relationship. Nonetheless, when we're able to gather these kinds of numbers, it gives us some information. Next slide, please. So I want to show you very quickly a couple of pieces of information from Dr. Gary Naumi's Workplace Bullying Institute. He, since 2003, the Institute has been conducting nationwide studies on workplace bullying. I will qualify these by just saying these are people who are self-selected because they're probably going out and Googling workplace bullying and then getting led to this website where they can participate in a survey. So it's not a totally random population that Dr. Naumi studies each year. However, it's, again, some information that can be helpful. So in 2014, next slide, there were 1,000 respondents who visited the website and participated in the survey. Next slide. Of those 1,000 respondents, 20% had been bullied in the past. 7% were currently being bullied. 21% had witnessed the bullying of a coworker or a colleague. So almost 50% of the people who, you know, responded in this online survey had had some exposure to bullying. There were about 23% who were aware that bullying occurred, but they hadn't been either subjected to it or they had not witnessed it. And then 28% were unaware of bullying at work at all, and so they hadn't had any experience or any exposure. So, next slide. Based on this study, and I will say that this may or may not be representative of anything, but based on this study, it appeared that more of the bullies were men, and that men seemed to prefer targeting women. When women were the bullies, they tended to target other women. And the rarest would be for a woman to bully a man or for men to be bullied by a woman. Next slide. This is very, very sad because it's one more example of in our society so often the victim gets blamed. Targets are more likely to lose their jobs than perpetrators are. If the perpetrator loses their job, this perpetrator is more likely to be a woman. So, in terms of men and women both being perpetrators, if the woman is a perpetrator, she's more likely to lose her job than a man is. Next slide. So from this study in 2014, 29% of the targets voluntarily left their jobs. 19% were forced to leave when conditions worsened, and we don't know for sure, but maybe these were people who became ill because of the conditions. And 13% were terminated by their employer. So next slide, 61% of the targets lost their jobs or left their jobs. Again, like I said, so often in our society, it's the victim who gets blamed. Next slide. And then 13%, this is a favorable outcome, 13% of targets transferred to another location with the same employer. So this would have been an employee who was able to retain their all the benefits that they had accrued in this work environment. Next slide. 11% of perpetrators were punished but kept their jobs. Only 10% of perpetrators were terminated by their employer, and 5% of perpetrators left their jobs voluntarily. Next slide. So only about 1 in 4 of perpetrators have any consequences, and only 15% lost their jobs or left their jobs. Next slide. So again, consequences appear, at least via this study, appear to favor the perpetrator over the target. Next slide. So here are a few telltale signs. I know that we are running short of time, but these are some of the things that we would see in a workplace that would give us some hints that bullying may be going on. I'm suspecting I'm out of time. Is that correct?
You're about there, yes.
Okay. Well, I will let you, examine these remaining slides at your leisure. I will say that I feel very honored to have been invited to share with you this morning. It was really an honor for me to have my work published by National Association of Social Workers. And as Lisa and I had consulted via phone and email, social work at its core has an obligation to, you know, be concerned and advocate for social justice. And very surprisingly, very few of the studies conducted in the United States or around the globe have been within the domain of social work or psychology or counseling and therapy. Most of the studies that have appeared around the globe are coming out of business and organizational behavior and human resources. So my hope is that this will help in your gathering of information for addressing this severe and growing problem of emotional abuse at work.
Thank you very much, Dr. Balcizak. Can you stay with us for a few minutes?
I will.
Okay. We'll hear from a couple of other people, and then I know I have a couple of questions. So, yes, if you could quickly introduce yourself and
good morning.
Share your thoughts. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Susie Brenton. Thank you, Senator Dembrough, for having us here this morning, hear our testimony. I'm from Portland, where I grew up. I graduated from college in 1978 and began teaching high school art. When school funding prevented a steady job in art, I retrained in 1987 to become an elementary teacher. I was very happy and enjoying my third graders in Southeast Portland when the principal who hired me retired. And we were told that the new principal was transferring to our school due to problems she had at her former school. She brought with her several teachers from that school. At first, I was very accepting and loyal towards her. We had a good relationship. But by the beginning of the following year, I was anxiously driving to school each morning, wondering what kind of drama I would encounter from her or her loyal followers. What I experienced was a principal who divided us by loyalty. Either you were with her or you were against her. After 2 years with this supervisor, I left the school along with at least seven others, specifically because of her and the unhealthy atmosphere that she created. Here are just a few of the experiences of teachers and staff at this school over probably 4 years. After the first year, after this principal's first year in the building, a close friend and respected teacher retired early because, in her words, "I can't work for her." The principal had several teachers that she wanted to get rid of. Those were her words, "get rid of," and would harass them regularly. Two of her loyal transfers would speak openly in front of other teachers and staff about how can we get rid of teacher X, Y, or Z. "I'm going to be your shadow and follow you everywhere," the principal told one teacher who was physically disabled. Following this, the teacher transferred to another school, where sadly that principal put her in a classroom on the second floor of a building with no elevator. On another occasion, the principal and one of her loyal teachers alleged that a fifth grade teacher had grabbed the arm of a student in the office. The following week, the teachers were required to attend an extra staff meeting where we were arranged in a large circle. We were asked to take turns commenting on the subject. I declined when it was my turn. I repeated the story to another principal who replied that this was not advised or legal in the Portland district to conduct such a meeting. On another occasion, the librarian went to the cafeteria at lunch on her free time to volunteer her assistance. As you can imagine, the cafeteria is a very lively place and extra help is always welcome. In the librarian's words, the principal, "She came flying at me like a madwoman. She yelled and screamed that I was in the wrong place." The principal required the school secretary to stand up and greet her when she arrived in the morning. This secretary experienced regular abuse from the principal and eventually sought counseling to cope with feelings of paranoia and suicide. She left the school. At the end of the principal's first year, she told me she wanted me to attend a two-week course at the art museum. I was a little taken aback because I'd already fulfilled my continuing ed education coursework for certification, and I had other plans for the summer, but I felt the pressure and I attended. One of the instructors was a delightful and respected teacher from another Portland school who a few years earlier was supervised by this principal, and she shared this story with me. Outside the evaluation process, she was told she needed to learn how to be a better teacher. Following that, this teacher came in to be instructed by the principal before school and before her contracted time each morning. My direct experience with this out-of-balance principal was less dramatic than most. When she sensed that I was no longer on her team, she and her loyal followers began to criticize me and fabricate mistakes that I made on district procedures. In response to her abusive ways, I met with the principal, along with two other teachers. Two of us stated our concerns, which were disregarded, and the third teacher was so intimidated she couldn't say what was on her mind. Later in the year, about five of us met with our principal's supervisor to share our concerns. His response was, we just don't understand her sense of humor. So it was time for me to find another school. And this was after I met with a union rep and we met with the principal. That meeting was unproductive. Nothing changed. When I informed the principal I was going to find another school, she asked if I wanted some help with that. When I told her no thanks, what I saw was remarkable. She had a visceral reaction. Her eyelids began to get heavy and fluttered. We all knew that this meant she was not happy or that she was angry. And then she began to sink very low in her chair. It looked to me as if her body was losing power. The last story I encountered was a fictional book the principal wrote about an elementary school. It is a thinly veiled representation of the school where I worked under this principal. Actual teachers are easily identified. They are made out to be ridiculous and pathetic, and the students are hopelessly dysfunctional. All of this took place a long time ago, and I, of course, don't recall all of what happened, but in writing this testimony, I can feel the stress of that experience again. An abusive work environment pervades every part of a person's life. An employee's well-being is affected, and it absolutely distracts from giving their best. In closing, I'm reminded of the time I encountered a bully while standing in a long line at the Home Depot with my then 7-year-old son. The bully went to the front of the line and began harassing the clerk about something he was not able to help him with. After a while, I intervened, and the man told me, "You're not my mother, and this is none of your business." It occurred to me later that bullies are everybody's business. So I thank you for taking up this important issue and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good morning.
Ms. Shattuck.
Yes. For the record, my name is Janet Shattuck. Let me thank Senator Dembrough and the members of this committee for this opportunity for me to provide additional testimony. First, let me introduce myself. I'm a native Oregonian. My parents came to Oregon after World War II and graduated from Oregon State on the GI Bill. They are the proud members of the class of 1950. They stayed in Corvallis, where I was born and raised. I graduated from Crescent Valley High School and then went on to Oregon State myself, earning bachelor degrees in music and business with a minor in computer science. I moved to Portland and started my career as a mainframe programmer working for a logistics company. I wanted to grow my career, so I started working for a financial company where I started out as a programmer analyst. I always had positive performance reviews and had excellent managers and mentors who believed in me. After 8 years, I was promoted to an application manager in the information technology department. I grew in this role and eventually managed a team of 15, including managers, analysts, and programmers. With the evolution of computers and technology, it is typical for the IT department to reorganize. I went through many reorganizations in my career, working for around 12 different managers in 23 years. They were all very positive relationships with my immediate manager. But then that changed. My team was reorganized again under a new manager. The reorganization seemed logical from a technology standpoint, and I thought things were going well until I had my first performance review with my new manager. It was my first negative performance review ever. My new manager thought I was a poor manager of my staff. My staff had always given me positive feedback. We worked well as a team. My new manager also felt some people on my team were not performing well. I felt pressure to focus on the negative things my team was doing and give needs improvement scores on their performance reviews. My management style was to mentor my team in areas of concern but not focus on the negative. But I was on the needs improvement list myself, so I complied. The result was devastating. I was so upset telling people they were not doing well, and obviously they became very defensive. The stress level on the team increased. We were already on edge trying to get big projects installed, and since the downturn in the economy, we were continually asked to do more with less. As a result, one person quit. Another person with 36 years of service to the company went on disability for stress and then took early retirement. Another person transferred to another team, not in a career advancement, but to get away from my manager in fear of being fired. I was eventually fired within 5 months of my negative performance review, unable to make the necessary improvements desired despite working 60-plus hour weeks consistently for those 5 months. The day I was let go, my daughter said, "Yay, now I don't have to see my mom cry anymore." After I left, within 5 months, three more people left the team to work for different managers. I did talk to human resources about the stress and the complete change in the perception of the quality of my work, even though I was the same hard worker I'd always been. I've always been open to suggestions for improvement in my work, but this was different. I could not improve. I went to my doctor due to the stress and was referred to a therapist for sessions to help me through this difficult change in my career. I did try to find work elsewhere at the company, but there was nothing at my grade level, and I would have had to take a drop in grades and pay to stay on. Also, I felt a need to protect my team from our manager, and I didn't feel right about abandoning them. Since my being fired, I was on unemployment for a few months before being hired by a consultant company as a computer systems analyst. I enjoyed the work I was doing well with positive feedback, but I was let go due to budget cuts. I'm currently on unemployment again looking for similar work. How could one person forever change the lives of seven people? Were we all just bad employees skating by until this person came into the picture to illuminate the truth? Or was this person a bully, trying to climb the career ladder, thinking this is how you treat people to get ahead in the business world? Obviously, we had different management styles, and if you can't be what your immediate manager thinks you should be, then you are out. But one person in a company should not have this much control. There should be a way to work with HR to point out that perhaps there are not seven bad employees, but one bad manager. I asked this of HR, but was told that if a manager thinks you are a poor performer and can document it, then there's nothing they can do. I agree we can all improve, and we shouldn't be coddled, but we shouldn't be intimidated either. As Lisa Stein pointed out, there are many stories, including hers, where people are harassed and intimidated, not because they are incompetent at their job, but because there's one person who has ultimate control over them to say otherwise. I thank you for listening to Lisa, Dr. Balzerzak, and Susie, and myself.
Thank you very much, Ms. Shadda. Thank you all for your testimony and your stories. We do have a legislative concept that's going to be introduced today as a committee bill to address this. And I guess my first question would be, this may be for you, Dr. Balzerzak, or for Lisa. Are there any, well, Dr. Balzerzak, you had mentioned that a lot of work had been done in Europe on this issue. Are there other states that have, in your opinion, taken the lead in getting on top of this problem? You mentioned that all the states have laws affecting some forms of bullying, but the other more subtle forms, perhaps not. So are there other states that are kind of leaders in this area?
That's a really good question. Thank you. You know, there's been some work that's gone on over the past decade or so where 30 states and two territories have introduced some attempted to introduce legislation. Sometimes it doesn't make it out of committee. Sometimes we even have a few examples of something making it out of committee onto the floor of the House or Senate and then getting to the governor's desk, and the governor would veto it. The most recent things that I'm aware of, and I will, as a California person, I will say that in 2014, the California legislature voted or enacted a mandatory training requirement for anybody in either the public or private sectors who have 50 or more employees. They're required to provide workplace bullying training to all managers and supervisors, and that law went into effect in January 2015. How that's being rolled out, really, what I've observed is that it looks like employers are simply attaching a little bit of bullying information to their sexual harassment training, which, in my opinion, isn't really adequate. The state of Tennessee enacted a requirement for employers to provide training, but what it really does is, in public sector employers only, what it really does is holds the employer harmless if they have delivered training or provided training. If bullying occurs, then the employer's obligation is nil. Massachusetts has had some activity, although nothing has been put in place. Some very interesting anti-bullying legislation was passed within Franklin County, Georgia, which is where Atlanta, Georgia is, but it's only countywide. And I'm sure there is activity going around a variety of states, and whether it's at the state level or the county level or city level, but we really have not made much progress here, and the European community is so far ahead. These behaviors have been illegal in European employment for more than two decades.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Colleagues, any questions? Yes.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And thank you for this excellent testimony. I just had one quick question. I think this would not apply in Oregon, but I'm curious whether people have been successful in filing workers' compensation claims for either the physical or psychological conditions that result from these incidents that you're describing. In Oregon, we very strictly limited the definition of occupational diseases, so that I think, although I'm rusty on this, it would be pretty hard to get an accepted claim for purely stress-related conditions. But in other states, things are not as limited as they are here in Oregon. So does anybody have an answer to whether the workers' compensation system has provided a remedy in these cases or a partial remedy?
I'll respond to that, Dr. Balserzak again. Yes, actually in my book I have a chapter that kind of examines the legal ramifications and how the laws, how our current laws are inadequate. Workers' compensation claims have been waged and have been decided in many cases in favor of the plaintiff. What appears to be necessary is, number one, there has to be evidence that the work environment, a reasonable person would find the work environment to be a hostile one, and number two, that the target of the hostility sustains health care damage, whether it's physical or psychological damage. But yes, it is possible to file. It's just very, very expensive, very labor-intensive. And like victims of sexual assault, people who come forward are subjected to examination that's very intrusive and the courts have continued to pretty much favor employers.
Mm-hmm. Thank you,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Great. Dr. Belsack, I have one other question.
Sure.
Uh, you know, your research showed, you know, I think you said that in 13% of the cases, victims were moved to another position, and that's the optimal kind of way of dealing with a hostile work environment where the hostility doesn't cease. So is there research to show, you know, what happens to the person after they're transferred? I mean, do they find themselves again in a problematic situation? What happens to that work environment after the person leaves? Does the problem go away? And, you know, just to get an understanding of what the pattern is the pattern a function of the employee, or is the pattern the function of the bully?
That's a really good question. And the 13% figure just came out of that 2014 Workplace Bullying Institute study. So I don't know that we can generalize that to the population, but that's at least what Dr. Nami found in 2014. What happens whether a person stays within the same organization and moves or just leaves the organization, the tendency is for the work environment to look at the departure as the victim's choice. And the bullying can even occur once that person is no longer there, whether they've moved to another department or another agency within the organization. And the question of is it the person or is it the work environment or is it the bully, the answer to that question is it's all of the above. It can be the structure of the work environment that creates the bullying. It can be that the bully is a very mean-spirited person or mean-spirited group of people. I think it's possible that the person who is a target may have behaved in a provocative manner. But there's nothing that suggests that people are bully-prone and that they create this for themselves much of the time. Certainly, it can occur. It can occur, but it just like with sexual assault or a family violence, it's not helpful or kind to look at the problem and blame the victim for the problem.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
Did that answer your question?
Yes, it does, and it really does jibe with my own experience you know, I've actually seen a lot of, positive mm-hmm. experience where people were in an environment, they moved to another, and suddenly someone who had been perceived to be non-productive and a problem just really flourished. And I've also seen where someone who was perceived to be a bully and creating a hostile work environment as a supervisor, when that person left the organization, suddenly the workplace really blossomed in a lot of ways.
I've seen yeah. both of those as well.
Right.
I tend to concur.
Yeah. Yes, Senator Thatcher.
I do have a question. It looked like there had been a lot of research in the United States as to percentages of people bullied in the workplace and whatnot, and you mentioned that they were way ahead in Europe in making these things illegal. I'm wondering if there has been any research that shows that those laws have actually worked to reduce workplace bullying in Europe.
Are there studies to suggest that having laws in place can be helpful? The short answer to that question is yes. Workers in the United States tolerate behavior from employers and managers and supervisors that workers in most developed countries, haven't seen in perhaps a whole generation. And one of the explanations for that is U.S. work environments tend to be more hierarchical rather than egalitarian. And just in terms of culture, in the United States, the workforce is more bullying tolerant than we might find in Scandinavia or the UK or the rest of Western Europe. So yes, having laws in place absolutely does help.
Okay, thank you, all of you.
Thank you.
You know, this bill, as I said, there's a legislative concept that will be introduced and find its way into the 2017 agenda, most likely of this committee. So you'll, those of you on the committee, those of us on the committee will have a chance to come back to this issue. So thank you very much. And Dr. Belsack, thank you for calling in.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
Great.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Okay, so the next item that we have on the agenda is has to do with sick leave. You know, we passed the sick leave policy a couple of years ago, and it has been in effect in the state for the last year. And so I asked Paloma Sparks from Boley to come and give us a preliminary report of how things were going in the implementation of the sick leave law. And also, as you know, there's been some rulemaking conversations and that I think may lead to some legislative action next session. So, Paloma, could you come up and give us a state of the nation with respect to sick leave?
Good morning. For the record, Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you for having me. So, as you know, the Senate Bill 454 passed in the 2015 session. It was signed by the governor in June, and we began immediately working on rulemaking after the session ended in early July. So the rulemaking process involved a diverse coalition of business advocates, worker advocates, agency representatives to try and figure out all the moving pieces of how do we implement this new statewide program. The final rules were adopted in December of 2015. The law went into effect January of 2016. This first year, there's a phase-in. So other than claims for retaliation, there won't be any civil penalties applied for violations of the sick time law. I've provided you with a sort of a list of statistics of complaints that the Bureau has received, mostly the wage and hour division, because all of the civil rights complaints are all retaliation complaints. There's no additional information to be gleaned from that. We received.
And if I could just interrupt for a moment, colleagues and members of the public, there are several documents on OLIS that you can reference, including these stats and a couple of memos from Paloma.
Yes. So we received 54 civil rights complaints for retaliation. Those went to investigation. Then we received 245, give or take, complaints for the wage and hour division. Variety of basis for that. Sometimes it was failure to provide a notice, failure to provide the information on the pay stub or information about hours that were remaining. Failure to allow the use of sick time, failure to pay for sick time. Those are sort of the most common ones. Then there were also complaints about, a handful of complaints about failure to pay for medical verification when requested, accrual calculation issues. So all of that information is available to you, but right now, in this first year, what we do is we just send a warning letter to the employer, letting them know the sick time law is passed, they need to comply with it. We received a complaint, but we will not be investigating further at this time. Starting January 1, 2017, that'll change, and those complaints will start getting investigated. So the rules went into effect January 1, 2015. We've moved along. As a new program, I'm sure it's not surprising to anybody, there's been confusion and sort of discussions back and forth about, you know, what does this language mean in the statute? What does this language mean? So in the February 2016 session, a number of bills were introduced. We were asked by legislative leadership to take a look at doing some new rules. advocates on both sides agreed during the 2016 session that we would take a look at rules related to clarifying front-loading and transitions for employers who use a non-calendar year, clarifying for employers' obligations under joint employment, and limiting the protected hours to the first 40 hours of a paid time off policy. As we began our rulemaking, we were also requested to take a look at several more issues that we hadn't had agreement during the session on. Excluding owners and family members from counting towards the employee total, holiday pay and its interaction with anti-retaliation provisions, clarification of a site and headquarters, it's mostly related to the site located in the city of Portland, changing rules regarding the regular rate of pay and piece rate, clarifying the 90-day waiting period, and clarifying how front-loading applies to temporary employees who are then hired as permanent employees. So around July 2016, we began our rulemaking. We started looking very carefully back at the statute, back at our existing rules. It became clear to us that a lot of the requested changes that we were hearing was not consistent with the statutory language. The existing rules are sufficient, and they are in line with the statutory language, and we are comfortable with enforcing the bill going forward. But if there is a desire for different policies to be enacted, then the statutory language needs to be fixed. There's also a variety of sort of discriminator's errors in the statute. The work study exemption has been is missing a word that it should have. And then the ability of employers to adopt policies limiting employees to accruing no more than 80 hours in a year and carrying over no more than 40. We did draft proposed rules, and the proposed rules added clarifications for the definition of the term employee and exclusions from that definition. What it means to maintain a location in Portland, we created an exemption for temporary locations. So like a temporary farm stand, for example, would probably not be considered maintaining a location in the city of Portland. How businesses should calculate the regular rate of pay for employees paid on a piece rate basis. This didn't change the obligation of employers to pay employees paid on a piece rate basis their regular rate of pay. It merely provided guidance to employers on how that one would calculate that regular rate of pay. It clarified joint liability for joint employers, added some additional clarifying language for re-employed employees and sick time, so employees who are rehired after within 180 days or after 180 days. And then additional language about undue hardship and sick time. So these were clarifications. They weren't essential changes to the rules, but they were to provide some additional guidance to employers. As we were moving towards finalization of the rules, it became clear that there was a lot of sort of confusion about whether or not what the statutory language meant. Our existing rules are consistent with statutory language, but we decided that given how close we were to the legislative session and the possibility of legislative changes, we were just going to hold off on finalizing those rules. So that is an overall summary of where we are.
Thank you for that, Paloma. And colleagues, I was involved in the rulemaking advisory process, and you know, I think that, you know, the way that Paloma has reported it, you know, is of course very accurate. And there was, I think there was a fair amount of agreement among the parties there, not total agreement, about some of the changes, and then some disagreement about others. You know, I think it, you know, it does make sense that, for some of the changes, for us to come back and take a look at in the next session, and clarify what the you know, what the intent was. You know, we're talking about, in, you know, from my perspective, you know, we're not talking about the fundamentals of the program at all, but just, you know, some of the, you know, kind of definitions of, as Paloma said, how exactly is piece rate handled? How exactly, who counts as an employee and an employer in different kinds of employment settings, with respect to things that, you know, as I recall, we never really talked about. We didn't think about those situations. But of course, when something gets out there, then you have to think through them. And that's why, fortunately, we meet every year, and changes can be made. The LC that we'll be asking you to put into the queue goes into absolutely no detail at all. It's a classic placeholder. I think it says that Boley will study changes or something like that. And then that, of course, will be changed into specific proposals as the session comes to us. Having said that, any questions for Paloma about the, you know, the experience so far, or about plans going forward? Senator Knope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paloma, I think last week there was a court decision regarding the unfunded mandate argument. Can you talk about Boley's response to that and what they plan to do going forward with the remaining counties?
Thank you, Chair Denbrough, Senator Knope. So that is the Linn County versus the Labor Commissioner and the Governor. That lawsuit did just have a summary judgment motion. It was a summary judgment motion only on one of the summary judgment motions. It was a summary judgment decision only on one part of the summary judgment motions. So it's still under review, determining sort of what we're going to do going forward. Technically speaking, that ruling would only apply to the counties who filed in that lawsuit, so which is, I believe, only 9 counties. So DOJ is still reviewing it. We haven't made any final determinations. I believe we will be asking the Linn County Circuit Court to revisit the other parts of the summary judgment motions. But I will keep you informed as we know more.
Do you think we'll have an answer before session?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Knope, yes. I believe that we will have an answer within a few weeks.
Okay. And if I could just interject. So what does an answer mean? An answer about whether there'll be an appeal or the actual, you know, the finalizing of the ruling? Or what do you mean by that?
So the counties have until January 7th to submit a judgment and finalize that judgment. We then, the state would then have 30 days to appeal. At that point, once a determination is made whether or not to appeal, we will revisit the issue and determine what our enforcement stance will be going forward.
Okay. Does that answer your question?
It does. I have another question, though.
Go ahead.
So in regards to the piece rate and the worker count, employee count, There's obviously some disagreement about whether or not you're within the legislation as it relates to the intent and the actual wording. So is that something that you plan to take up in the 2017 session, or are you just going to maintain that there isn't an issue there?
Chair Denborough, Senator Knope, I have provided a lengthy memo that sort of provides some background and some analysis around this issue. The problem is that the statutory language says that employees who are paid on a piece rate basis must be paid their regular rate of pay. And that is the initial language in the statute. It's so piece rate is a regular rate of pay. So we have a statutory problem. If the idea is that you would urge the agency to adopt a different interpretation, it would require us to ignore that statutory language. On the worker count, there the existing language says that an employee, the exemption from the employee says that an employee does not include an individual employed by that individual's parent, spouse, or child. A corporation cannot be a parent, spouse, or child of an individual. So where the corporation is the employer, then you cannot extend that language. And that exemption was taken out of existing statute, and we have always interpreted that to be limited to a sole proprietorship. That is still our interpretation. So if a sole proprietorship is employing their parent, spouse, or child, then those individuals are exempt.
So these are the things that we're going to have to come back and kind of clarify. I mean, I'll say, I've said for the record before that, you know, in envisioning an employment situation, I personally was thinking of the sole proprietorship kind of setting, you know, a family that owns a business. But as we got into rulemaking, we were reminded that there are all sorts of situations out there. And so I think we just need to reach clarity of how we want to want this to be covered. Absent that clarity, Boley apparently relied on their existing way of looking at things, which I think makes sense. And the same thing is probably true in the piece rate area, where we were assuming, you know, the notion of a regular rate of pay, you know, we were thinking of the situation in which someone is employed and seasonally they may be earning at a piece rate level, and then at other times, if they're kept on for the whole year, they may have a regular rate of pay for doing maintenance and other kinds of things. You know, how exactly to handle the situation in which someone only is at piece rate has become problematic, because Boley traditionally looks at them in a certain way. So. Okay. Yes. Any other questions for Paloma? All right, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so for our last two information items, we return to the world of workforce development, and particularly focusing on young future or current but also future employees. Work coming out of our task force, our work group on youth employment. We're first going to get a report from the Youth Development Council. Iris Bell, the director, and Cord Bucher, who focuses on youth employment, and they're going to talk to us about the YDC's particular efforts with respect to those young people who are neither in school nor in a work situation. So, welcome.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee. My name is Iris Bell, and I'm the Executive Director of the Youth Development Council. I'm here this morning with Cord Bucher, who's a Youth Development Council Workforce Policy Analyst. And as Senator Dembrough has indicated, we're here to give you an overview of the workforce with respect to the Senate Bill 586. And that bill passed unanimously in 2015, and it raised the age limit for youth that we would serve with respect to the council. So the age limit went from 20 to 24. It also aligned our with our target population, which is opportunity youth, and that is those youth who are neither in school nor working, ages 16 to 24. And so they are disengaged from both the workplace and the educational environment. The higher range, with that higher range came the expectation that there could potentially be a need for some additional funds for the Youth Development Council to actually serve that higher level group of young people. And the legislature did provide us with funds to actually hire the workforce policy analysts that would do the research and actually do the community engagement necessary to determine whether or not, indeed, we would need some additional funds. And so Cord was hired and has done an extensive, comprehensive look at what is happening in the world of work and career development for these young people, and is going to share that with you this morning. And so with that, Cord, why don't you go ahead and start, and of course, we'll hold questions till the end.
Good morning, Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee. My name is Cord Bucher, Workforce Policy Analyst for the Youth Development Council. Thank you for giving us an opportunity to share this report with you this morning. I'll begin by talking about the community engagement process that we engaged in. It consisted of several different components. Of course, there was extensive travel, and we held community meetings, visited service providers, and spoke with a variety of stakeholders involved in youth workforce development, as well as community leaders and business folks and other people with an interest in this. We looked at national research, trends and data regarding opportunity youth and youth employment. We reviewed the YDC investments from 2015-17 that have workforce components for youth, and we were able, through the use of some unallocated funds from 2015-17, to develop a workforce-focused grant. That's the Entrepreneurship and Career Readiness Grant, which allowed us to provide funding to support some projects that are targeting young people ages 16 to 24, primarily those that are disconnected, some who are underattached to education and work, and try some innovative strategies to train them. And so I'll just talk briefly about the community meetings and the work we did. We had a set of questions that we asked everywhere we went, and these were really focused on the challenges, the barriers, needs, and the services for these young people in communities across the state. We specifically asked about the challenges of serving older youth, given that the Senate Bill 586 expanded our age range, and tried to really get at the challenges for serving that older population, and we have recommendations for those youth. We also tried to find out what was working really well and what folks wanted to do, and get a sense of some of the vision that communities had for how to reengage these youth and prepare them for success. And I'll mention that at the end of the full report, there's an appendix that shows all the locations that we visited and held community meetings, as well as the organizations that we spoke to as part of this process. So I'll talk briefly about opportunity youth, just to define who it is we're speaking about. So opportunity youth, as mentioned, are 16 to 24-year-olds who are not engaged in work or education. The number is estimated based on the American Community Survey, so it's hard to pinpoint, especially in rural areas. And we would recommend that there be some more research and data collection done mm-hmm. around the actual numbers throughout the state. But the estimate for 2014 was about 58,000 youth. The year previous was about 68, so the number moves around. It's affected by economic conditions, but it remains. and in 2014 that represented about 13% of all 16 to 24-year-olds in the state. And you can find them everywhere in the state, and in every county. The largest concentration is in the metropolitan area. However, you can find some very high rates in rural counties in Oregon where there's data, and we'll talk about that later in this report. So in terms of the responses that we received in our community engagement process, there were some key challenges that were shared with us. Those are limited job opportunities for young people, need for skills and work experience, and a lack of positive models for professional behaviors for youth. And we heard a lot from young people about their challenges entering the workforce. They in particular pointed out that there were limited jobs, but then when they had the opportunity, when they had the opportunity to apply for something, they often found that having no experience with work was a big barrier. Along with that, there were some critical needs that needed to be met, and these are listed here. Housing instability and homelessness were brought up in every community we visited. Transportation is a challenge. It's acute in rural areas due to just the lack of availability of public transportation, for example, but it's also difficult throughout the state. Mental health care and counseling was brought up everywhere we went. I know that also was mentioned in the first report this morning. Child care, as noted, is rather costly. In the report, we don't give a specific number since it might not be something that's new year-round, but even for youth to engage in training, finding consistent child care can be a challenge and outside of their ability to pay for it. And then life skills. For a lot of young people, there's a variety of skills that either for lack of modeling or exposure, they do not have, and those that lack of skills can prevent their success in the workplace. And so in this report, we also talk about some of the key investments that are already being made by state and federal funds in workforce development. We provide an overview of those programs, and I've listed those here. And it should be noted that the recommendations that we make in the report are compatible and aligned with these other efforts. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the recommendations that we've put forward and some of the needs that were pointed out in more depth now. When we talk about work experience for youth, this is a really critical piece here, and it's valuable for a number of reasons. It gives young people a chance to practice and refine a variety of skills, the soft skills that are considered to be critical for hiring, including time management, communication, and problem solving. It gives young people a chance to explore careers, to determine what their goals and ambitions are. There's a lot of research that points to increased future earnings, improved likelihood of high school graduation, and increased opportunity for future employment for young people who work. And another consideration is that employed young people pay taxes. There is data in the report on an estimated loss of state income tax revenue from an unemployed youth. The estimate for Oregon is around $1,400 annually for a young person who's unemployed. And of course, it's variable depending on how much they work and how much they get paid, but it is a loss nonetheless if they're not working. And I've got examples of a few programs that we highlight in the report doing great work around both the training for employment and paid employment. And I'm going to go ahead and move on. I'm going to move rapidly through this since it is a long slideshow and I know we don't have a lot of time. Entrepreneurship was something that I was really excited to learn about some of the work being done around the state and nationally on this as a strategy for youth workforce development. We really looked at this in the grant that we just put out. The skills that a young person needs in order to be successful with an entrepreneurship, leadership, problem solving, communication, et cetera, are useful in the workforce and they're useful in education as well. But it can also tap into youth interests. It can motivate young people who have not had success in the workplace or at school. And it also gives them firsthand experience of what it is to run a business. One of the first things we heard in our community engagement was from a county commissioner who talked about his own experience running a business and how young people didn't understand that it cost money when they didn't do the work they were supposed to do, or he talked about them hiding in the bathroom on their cell phones and not recognizing that's a cost. And when we talked to programs that teach entrepreneurship, they talked about, and the young people also expressed this surprise at what it actually takes to run a business and the costs that are involved. And I think exposing young people to that might actually be a great way to get them to be more aware of what they're getting into when they go to work. It can also be a great place to provide financial literacy training, which I think has value both as a life skill and also for young people that are pursuing higher education. It's very valuable. And in some rural communities, entrepreneurship programs for youth might also be a way to help young people who have a difficult time finding entry-level employment to identify skills and services that they can employ to employ themselves. I've highlighted here a few programs that we spoke with and looked at that are doing work in entrepreneurship training for young people. And there's descriptions in full of some of these programs within the report. I did want to mention a few things that are key to the success of an entrepreneurship program for youth. When we looked at this, there are some things that we want to make sure happen in a successful program. This would be connectivity to the local business community. Certainly financial literacy for young people is important in understanding what they're getting into. The access to investment is also another critical piece for young people who get very excited but are unable to access any resources to launch a business. That would be a big disappointment. Training on how to find the funding and working with investors is critical, but we also want to make sure above all that these skills are translated into workplace readiness and education-related skills, and that young people see that these can be articulated in different ways. A related strategy that we saw and really see a lot of promise in is social enterprise. And these are businesses that generally employ youth and reinvest the revenue from the business in the training program. They provide a supportive training environment for youth, so it's a real job, but there's also a youth-oriented focus and a lot of additional training and support that might go along with that work experience. They can use a variety of products and services, and on the next slide we'll highlight a few of the social enterprise projects that we looked at. So for example, Likebox is a coffee shop right near the Capitol. Salsa Del Rio is producing food products. Life Art Gallery is an art gallery. So it really is a versatile approach to teaching young people about employment and business. And it can also be a great venue for exploring entrepreneurial skills. And it's also a venue for mentoring. And mentoring was something we heard a lot about the need for. As mentioned earlier, modeling, particularly in communities with generational poverty, is a big need that was called out to us. And mentoring can provide the modeling of life skills and professional behavior for young people. As mentors share their experiences, they can transfer skills and institutional knowledge within a business. And there's a lot of benefit to the mentors as well. Anyone that's worked with youth can probably attest to this. For a mentor within the workplace, there's studies showing enhanced job satisfaction and an appreciation of one's own knowledge and skills. And some organizations that have provided youth with work experiences point to the leadership development that sort of supervision provides to their employees. And mentoring is often integrated into other programs. So two of these here were mentioned earlier. Around entrepreneurship and social enterprise, but mentoring is a key component to their training and service delivery. And the peer mentoring program was an interesting model because it basically trained young people who had just begun to find success within the workforce and higher education to be mentors for younger peers coming out of the same program that they had graduated from. And both groups were mentored by adult professionals from the community. So it was really a model designed to not just mentor young people, but to develop new mentors and pass it forward. As mentioned earlier, we asked questions about serving older youth, and there are some special considerations that we wanted to call out. We talked about 18 to 24-year-olds generally, and there are some things specific to the oldest opportunity youth, 21 to 24-year-olds. So in all cases, many times these young people need the same services as teens, but they may have fewer options to access those services. Mm-hmm. The resources that are required to engage and train, especially 21 to 24-year-olds, are more significant. There are additional costs, for example, around education. If a youth hasn't finished high school or GED, there may be costs associated with that. For an older youth, they're more likely to have a family to support. They may have dependents, and there are other things that can get in the way of pursuing training to advance in employment. Older opportunity youth are often difficult to locate, and we heard a lot about this in rural communities. They're harder to find, harder to engage. And another thing that was pointed out is that for these older youth, many do leave for educational employment opportunities and don't see anything that they can return for. So that's a slightly different concern, but it was something that was raised to us and we wanted to point it out. So these slides offer some recommendations around these areas, and in the interest of time, I'm going to breeze through these rather quickly. But when we talk about the older opportunity youth, one of the key things that may be helpful is extending eligibility ages for services where possible and where that's a limitation to access. but also strengthening connectivity between youth and adult services. In some areas, youth and adult services are co-located, but in many places, they're in different buildings and different organizations. And for a young person who's seeking training and having to move into the adult service sector, that transition can be a challenge. And we would recommend supporting that with specialized staffing. In terms of the need for greater resources, one of the things that was called out was that for more advanced training that does not provide opportunities to earn wages while youth are in training, young people will often leave those training programs in order to get living wage work so that they can support themselves or family. And it's been one of the challenges for some of these more ambitious, especially sector pathway training programs for opportunity youth. So finding ways to increase the wraparound supports and allow wage earning around these training opportunities would be a recommendation. In terms of reaching opportunity youth in rural areas, one of the things we did learn about is that there's limited access to workforce development programs in a lot of communities. And we'd be very interested in seeing efforts to provide more versatile service delivery, either through mobile services, pop-up training. We've heard of some interesting examples of that. And really trying to bring those services and reach those youth in the rural communities in Oregon. We also want to see more opportunities for those youth to engage and then be bridged into longer-term training. So, for example, in areas that do not have WIOA services available and youth who are seeking long-term training and skill development, finding a way to engage them, get them bought in, and then connect them with those programs might be really valuable. And then coming back to the issue that was brought up around young people leaving rural communities, we would like to see more connection between economic development and youth workforce training and really building young people's awareness of the opportunities within their communities and seeing that there's opportunities to stay and work. And we also like the possibilities presented by entrepreneurship programs to show young people ways to create jobs and opportunities for themselves within those communities and address the needs there. In the report, there's a few examples from Wallowa County where the Mentor Match program has had a number of youth who have completed the entrepreneurship training, gone on to higher education, and returned to start businesses in that community. And one of our findings that we did want to really call out was some of the unique challenges that rural and frontier communities have in terms of serving opportunity youth. It includes the challenges, as mentioned before, around locating those young people, but also limitations around transportation, housing availability, job opportunities, funding for services, and other resources. The outreach is significantly more difficult, but data points to higher percentages of opportunity youth in some rural areas. I have a comparison here of a few counties where we did have data. Jefferson County in 2013 had the highest rate of any county that had an appreciable number of opportunity youth. And one of the challenges, as mentioned before, is even getting data for rural areas because of how it is collected. But I think it's important that we look at this because it shows that the challenge of reengaging youth is not strictly an urban issue. And in fact, there's significant difficulty in providing those services in rural communities. So now I'll move on to the recommendations from this report. There were six key recommendations that shaped our recommendations for investment to fulfill Senate Bill 586. These are supporting programs that provide entrepreneurship training, social enterprise, mentoring, efforts to bridge adult and youth workforce services, expand service delivery, and provide stability and skills for older opportunity youth who are in training programs. And the recommendations are that there be a youth and workforce grant that the YDC would provide focused in three areas. So youth and workforce enterprise would be a grant that would focus on supporting entrepreneurship and social enterprise projects for opportunity youth. Youth and workforce mentoring would focus on projects that match opportunity youth with mentors, and youth and workforce bridge grants would support the expansion of workforce development services for opportunity youth. And one thing that is noted within the full report is that we'd like to have some flexibility between these funding sources because in many cases there might be opportunities to combine that. For example, mentoring and entrepreneurship seem to go hand in hand in many of the programs that we observed. Mm-hmm. And the funding recommendations are shown here. These grant amounts are similar to the grants currently distributed by the YDC in terms of their size. For each, we are looking at distributing 20 grants. The amount for the enterprise grant would be $150,000 per biennium, while the mentoring and bridge grants would be for $100,000 per biennium. The reason for the higher amount for enterprise would be to address the costs involved in supporting young people's entrepreneurial efforts, as well as social enterprise and work training that goes along with that. The total funding recommendation would be for $7 million per biennium, which would fund 60 grants. And the requirements for these grants would be similar to that of other YDC investments, in that communities must have a demonstrated need and must be planning or implementing collective impact in order to leverage other funds and resources to deliver these services. And the measurable outcomes would include employment placement and retention, educational re-engagement and completion, post-secondary placement, certifications and credentials, social enterprise and youth business indicators, and youth stability and avoidance of the justice system. Many of these are already being measured within current YDC grants, and particularly in the entrepreneurship and career readiness grants, we've been able to create a model for the data that we'd like to collect in a broader youth workforce development grant-making effort. The impact of these grants would be varied. It includes increasing the skills, work experience, and career readiness for opportunity youth, expanded service availability, alignment with existing services and systems, engagement of the business community through entrepreneurship, social enterprise, and mentoring, leveraged resources through collective impact, and we believe that these 60 grants could reach up to 5,000 youth statewide. And I'll just anticipate one of the questions, which is when we talk about 60,000 opportunity youth, but we talk about an effort to address 5,000, obviously that's a big difference, and there are a few reasons for that. One is we looked at the capacity for these particular programs in the YDC to manage this. We also looked at the broader systems that are addressing opportunity youth. And I think an important consideration for this population is that it's dynamic. It's an 8-year age range. It ranges from teenagers to young adults. That may include young people who are in and out of school, but it may also include young adults who are significantly barriered and disconnected from work. So the systems and the efforts that are addressing opportunity youth are widely varied, and this is just one part of a broader effort to reengage these youth. But if an effort to reengage an opportunity youth is successful and they can be permanently reengaged and employed, they're out of the count. And if you can get them when they're younger, I think that that has a significant impact on this long term. So we still believe that even if this doesn't reach the entirety of that population, it could have a significant impact on opportunity youth in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And with that, I'll conclude the presentation, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you may have about this.
So we also know that we've provided you with a significant amount of reading material. And we did that so that you could have really a comprehensive look at what we are proposing and to support your decision making as you go forward, and also to use as you go through several of your sessions with respect to having the data and the information on this particular population. So I do know that we did supply you with a significant amount of information there. And so if you have any questions.
Yes, great. Thank you very much. It's a very impressive report and a very impressive process, I think, particularly the statewide look and the conversations all over the state, which I think it gives us a lot to think about and a lot to work on. Mm-hmm. And this focus on opportunity youth is a national focus, right? It's part of in the recreation of the Workforce Investment Act. The word opportunity is actually in the act now, and there's a specific focus on these disengaged youth who need to be brought back into the productive mainstream.
Exactly. There is a national movement, and it's called Opportunity Nation, and it's recognizing the number of young people between the ages of 16 and 24 nationally who are out of work and who are not in school. And so the effort on a national level to begin to address the needs and support these young people is what we're seeing around. And states are taking significant steps towards addressing their youth populations. And I think that we too need to begin to address this population because it has a significant impact not only on the lives of young people, but it also has a significant impact on our state and our economy as well.
Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Just a point of clarification. What is the collective impact model? I heard it talked about, but I don't know what it is.
So, you can take it.
Okay. So the collective Chair Denver, Vice Chair Thatcher, the collective impact methodology is a model that takes a look at what can happen when communities come together and there's a limited amount of resource, but they want to work on a particular issue. And so a community comes together and they say, collectively, we are going to address homelessness in our community. And we're going to go through a process whereby we look at having a common agenda around that issue, a common way to communicate what that issue is. We're going to look at a common data set. And so, and we're going to look at how we then involve and engage the community collectively in the work. So in doing so, you're able then to take three or four community-based organizations who come together to work, as opposed to having to fund individual community-based organizations to do varying parts of a program. What they do is they collectively come together, they share in the grant or the resources, and they share in the outcomes that they're going to try and achieve around a particular targeted population. So collectively, a community works together. So we've encouraged that, given the meager funds that we have and the funds that folks have in projects. We've encouraged this collective look at how a community addresses an issue, and that has worked significantly well. You see the Southern Oregon Success Project. You see what's happening in Wallowa. All of these are efforts where communities come together to engage and support a particular concern or issue which they identify, and then they go through the process of working together to resolve.
So speaking of meager funding, of the $7 million that you think would provide the functional first start, how much of that is included in the proposed budget for next year at this point?
In our proposed budget for next year? Well, we included, I think about $6 million was what we were going to propose in our proposed budget for next year. However, we're not quite sure it's going to make it through in our budget. So.
Right. But is that included in the governor's budget at this point?
No, it is not.
Other questions? So one of the challenges that we identified in the youth employment work group is there are just a number of programs out there, and you've mentioned several of them, and I think the bringing together of those I think is one of the values of this report. Mm-hmm. But there's also the danger of things being too scattered and non-coordinated. And, I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit, just, mm-hmm. the need to figure out a way to coordinate these various activities, some coming through the workforce development boards, others through the, in some cases through higher education, others through business organizations, et cetera. Mm-hmm.
Sure, Chair Dimbrough and members of the committee. I think that first I'll say that in terms of the YDC's role within workforce development, one of the things that we've noted in the report is that we believe we can really assist all these systems in identifying and supporting best practices in youth workforce development. And that's I think, one critical piece that we can play in that. And in terms of distributing resources and aligning those resources with the workforce development boards and with other providers, organizations, businesses, et cetera, I think that in terms of utilizing a collective impact model for our proposed funding, we can look at in terms of how those funds would be distributed, either strongly encouraging or requiring connectivity, particularly for organizations that are not connected to a workforce board and having connectivity to those more advanced training models, or involving businesses where it's appropriate in broadening who's at the table and developing and delivering services. And I think that there's maybe also an additional opportunity to let me gather my thoughts on this, because I had an idea earlier that I wanted to share around this. Essentially, I think this is it is actually a huge challenge to align the variety of systems that we're looking at around youth workforce development. But the YDC's funding provides the opportunity to do innovative and very flexible work, flexible in terms of the duration, flexible in terms of the eligibility for young people to get involved, and flexible in terms of the types of services delivered. So I think that this can provide a way to examine best practices and develop best practices in conjunction with that larger system.
And in addition, it's our legislative charge. So we've been charged with taking a look statewide at alignment and continuity of services to young people. And so the ability for us to be able to bring people together and talk about alignment and continuity of services, and then to talk about how we collectively look at it, whether it's through a collective impact methodology or other means, to say how are we aligning these systems and how are we bringing them together and how are we leveraging the dollars that we actually have. And then where there are not those services, where you don't have a workforce board, how do you bring those communities together, whether it actually be through a school district or whether it be through a community-based organization. So we have been, as we've done this engagement process, actually looking at the fact that there are places where there is ideal continuity, where we could see folks come together and where we could work with folks to align services, and places where we would need to actually be on the ground and help support some of those efforts. And so it is in our charge and it is in our mandate to do just that.
Great. And I will say that we will have several bills coming out of the Youth Employment Task Force, some of which are going to be introduced as committee bills today, following up on that work, and that will be funding requests or providing tax credits to employers who hire youth. Some, you know, really great ideas that we're going to have to battle really hard to get through to the end next session. But they're definitely very important initiatives. I will say just finally, I'm very impressed with the proposals around entrepreneurship, and I wanted to share with you that I have a constituent, a young man, who attends my constituent coffees, and he's been involved in something that he's been doing called Startup Weekends. He himself he runs a computer repair operation, software repair, kind of thing. And he brings young people together on a regular basis for what he calls startup weekends, people who want to, start their own businesses and do, sort of peer sharing and peer support. He's been doing this now for over a year. And it's growing. And so what we've been talking about actually is piggybacking on some of the partnerships that I've been doing with my district, with Senator Hansel in his district in Eastern Oregon. And so I think we're organizing a startup weekend that will bring together young people in the Pendleton-Hermiston area and young people in the Portland area for kind of joint startup weekend. So we'll see where that goes. But I think we also need to sort of applaud and encourage those kinds of grassroots, truly startup operations as we can.
And this is where the council tries to lend its support in terms of making investments in communities. Those would be the kinds of things that we would really look at trying to support.
Great. Okay, thank you.
So thank you. Both.
Thank you.
Okay, next, our last informational session is, this is a different but related item, I believe, and it has to do with the proposal to create a joint CTE STEM council. Colleagues, you may remember that this is something we've been talking about for a couple of years. We had a proposal a couple of years ago to take the STEM Council and take the work that's been happening with respect to CTE revitalization grants, and just really recognize that these are really intertwined kinds of initiatives, and having them on completely separate tracks organizationally in the long run really doesn't make sense. When we looked at it a couple of years ago, the initiatives were still fairly young and maybe not yet at the point where they were each established enough to really come together. But I think there's a clear sense within the community that we're ready and it's time to move forward. We have an LC proposal as a committee bill that we'll be introducing. And to hear more about where we are in this initiative, two real stalwarts in the effort to increase positive futures for youth, Eric Meslow and Brian Krieg. Take it away.
Thank you, Senator Dembrough. For the record, Brian Krieg with the CTE and STEM Employers Coalition. I also am the co-chair of the CTE Grant Committee for the state. And with me, Eric Meslow is on the STEM Council and is part of the Employer Coalition also. Thanks, Senator Dembrough, for really setting the framework for that in all. This is something that has been evolving. And this journey that you as a committee have been on with us in forming new pieces of legislation, putting new grants forward, it continues to evolve, and the opportunity to do more in strategy at a high level for the state is really important, because we have currently the two entities that are somewhat different, but both working with great overlap. And that's why we brought the slide back. You've seen this one before of the great overlap between STEM and CTE. It's very hard in some cases to make a definition between the two on that. So experiential hands-on learning, I think, is at the core. Those who are moving ahead in STEM need to have that in the way of training. And our CTE folks need to have the science and math involved in it also for their jobs and for the future. So in coming together, the proponents for both have worked for the last couple of years here since the last time we brought a bill before you to rough out a new structure, and it's based really on what we have been doing, what's really in statute. It's not going to be a radical departure by any means. It's marrying the two up in a way that makes sense. And as the Senator Dembrough alluded to, we had a lot of new grants in this last session, and we've learned a lot more about how to manage those, work with that, and the strategies on that. And I think it was really a good idea to hold off on this merger until this point in time, where we've gained a lot of knowledge on it. So what I'd like to kind of note is the start here, a little bit of where we're at with the STEM Council and the CTE Grant Committee, what the slight differences are between them currently. The STEM Investment Council has nine members on it. They're all from business and industry. Their key duties are to develop a STEM investment plan. They're to advise the Chief Education Officer and the Governor on STEM issues. They have oversight of four STEM grant programs at the moment. And those STEM grant projects in the current biennium were for, in total, of roughly $10 million. Then we have the CTE Grant Revitalization Grant Committee. It has 23 members, and it has a little different function. Of those members, they're more or less equally 25% from business, industry, labor, and CTE education. The key duties for the grant committee is the oversight of the CTE revitalization grant program, which was really the one that kind of got us rolling in this path, and then three other sets of grants underneath that. But what the CTE grant committee did not have is more of that overarching role and duty to come up with any kind of a strategic plan. The Department of Education uses the grant committee often as a sounding board and a place to have discussions about how to shape policies and the grant programs and put them together. But we have not had any kind of formal strategic charge from the state. The STEM Council has created a STEM investment plan for the state, and it talks a lot about CTE within it. We need to expand that and add a few more elements to that plan, and this is part of the reason of bringing the two bodies together on that. The CTE grants all total last time for the biennium were $22 million, so it was about a $32 million package altogether that you put forward in the last for this biennium. The funds, last session we passed also, you passed, 3072, and that was a measure that did a number of things to create some things for a longer-term structure, one of them being a special account in the treasurer's office where funds that were dedicated for CTE and STEM grant programs could be put. It gave a charge to both the two entities, the council and the committee, with oversight of those grants, divided the funds roughly that would go into that account, 60% for CTE and 40% for STEM. But the two were still going to be functioning independently. So we would look at a new structure, would be building on that, but combining the two councils on it. As I say, we're not looking at radical changes, but mainly a blending of the structures. And actually, we would, in the proposal that we will have for you, the grant committee for CTE doesn't exactly go away in the unique way it is put together by both the Labor Commissioner and the Department of Education. It would function for most of what it does on the tactical level of implementing the grants, coming up with the rationales and the guidelines for them and the actual selection of them. But it would report to the new council, which would be called the what we're proposing is the CTE and STEM Investment Council. The voting members of a new council would be appointed by the governor, and the primary point of contact would be the Chief Education Office. That is a good place for us and something that we look at as very useful, because CTE and STEM really, there is the pre-K through 12 element to it, but we go on into higher ed. So the fact that with the chief education officer being unifying in the department of all the departments there makes a very logical spot for us to be reporting through to all of them. We would be, the charge would be to give advice to the executive director of HEC, the deputy superintendent of public instruction, and to the chief education officer and the governor. The rough structure would be 11 voting members of high level representation from business, industry, and labor. And then we would have non-voting ex officio members, and there would be 14 that are identified on that. Now, that seems to be a large group on the one hand, but this is, when you look at CTE and STEM and the fact that we're trying to connect education to careers, there are so many different agencies and groups involved with this that we need to have good tie-in between the different groups to come up with a strategy and structure. The non-voting members would include 4 members from the legislature, two each from each chamber, and it would be in a bipartisan situation on that. And those members would have to be involved in a committee such as this one, or the education committees have a role with us at some point down in the process. The next grouping is there would be 4 representatives from education, 1 CTE educator from grades 4 through 12, and a STEM educator from grades 4 through 12. And then we would have 1 CTE educator from post-secondary and 1 STEM educator from post-secondary. Then the other folks that would be on there, and they could have a designee come to the meetings and be participating. It would be the chief education officer, the deputy chief of public instruction, the chair of the higher education coordinating committee, yes, the commissioner of labor, the chair of the state workforce board, and the chair of the Oregon Talent Council. That provides us with links to all of the key groups that are involved with taking our youth, moving them through education to a career. And that latter part is something we really learned and leaned on a lot with the CTE grant committee in developing our policies over the years. Many members of the legislature, two of them who are here today, have participated with the CTE grant committee, either themselves in person and or with staff, over the life of that program. And I think that was valuable. And we also had numerous of the state agencies who came and helped in shaping that policy. So that, in a nutshell, is what the bill would do. And as I say, the duties really wouldn't change dramatically. The only main thing would be is that CTE would also then be looked at in planning more of at a strategic level, as the STEM Council has at this point, in blending the two.
Wow, I don't know if I need to say anything more. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, I'm here primarily as a member
could
of the
you
STEM.
Could you introduce yourself?
Oh, excuse me. Yeah, my name is Eric Meslow. I'm a business owner in Tualatin, Oregon. I've been on the STEM Investment Council since its beginning, and previously I've worked on STEM and workforce-related issues around higher education for approximately 10 years. I'm here basically to emphasize that this is a by-committee opportunity. The STEM Investment Council is fully behind this. It makes complete sense. Having been in this building for the last 10 years, the confusion associated with the difference between STEM and CTE has been a barrier at times in regards to making priorities for state investment. I do believe by having one single entity, it should help eliminate that. And then obviously the great synergies we'll have with strategic planning will continue to be emphasized. One of the things I can tell you guys is that we just formally published through the governor's office the STEM strategic plan. If you were to pick up a copy and read it, you could easily put CTE in every single place that it says STEM. And in fact, you'll see CTE mentioned throughout the entire document. So we're truly committed to this relationship, and it seems like a no-brainer. I know there's often difficulties in getting these things passed, but it really seems like it's a win-win for all involved.
Great. Thank you very much. You know, I think I've said before that, you know, for me, the light bulb moment was visiting with some robotics teams, you know, where you have a team and different people on the team have different expertise, areas of expertise. Some, you know, really good with the actual building of the robots, others with the coding, others with the sort of project management component of it. And, you know, so which of those are CTE students, which of those are STEM students? It's, you know, it's all of a piece, really. And I think that there's just we have too many arbitrary distinctions out there, and this is an effort to remove at least one of them.
Concur.
Colleagues, any questions about this initiative? Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, both of you, for coming.
Thank you.
Okay. So I'm going to close the informational hearing. Colleagues, let's just stand at ease just for a second before we enter our work session to introduce committee bills. Okay, I'm going to call us back into session, I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee legislative concepts. Colleagues, of course, as you know, this introduction of committee bills bears no reference to your feeling about the bill. This is just to get each bill into the process. So that it will become part of the agenda in 2017. perhaps, but it gets them into the queue. And so with that, Senator Rosenbaum, have you a motion to make?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel a motion coming on, and and here it is. I move that the following excellent LC drafts be introduced as committee bills: LC 305, dated October 20th of 2016, LC 1568, dated November 4th of 2016, LC 1570, dated November 14th, 2016, LC 1881, dated November 22nd, 2016. LC 1889, dated November 7th, 2016. LC 1913, dated October 11th, 2016. LC 2231, dated October 13th, 2016. LC 2542, dated December 2nd, 2016. LC 2715, dated October 19th, 2016. LC 2758, dated December 5th, 2016, LC 2819, dated November 10th, 2016, LC 2824, dated October 11th, 2016, and last but not least, LC 3008, dated October 7th of 2016.
Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum. Senator Rosenbaum has moved LC 305, dated October 20th, 2016, LC 1568, dated November 4th, 2016, LC 1570, dated November 14th, 2016, LC 1881, dated November 22nd, 2016, LC 1889, dated November 7th, 2016, LC 1913, dated October 11th, 2016, LC 2231, dated October 13th, 2016. LC 2542, dated December 2nd, 2016. LC 2715, dated October 19th, 2016. LC 2758, dated December 5th, 2016. LC 2819, dated November 10th, 2016. LC 2824, dated October 11th, 2016. And LC 3008, dated October 7th, 2016. These have all been moved to be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion, colleagues? Colleagues, you know, as I mentioned earlier, some of these bills are reflections of issues that we have discussed today. I do want to point out one of them, which I mentioned earlier. We have a proposal that came out of the Youth Employment Work Group related to a tax credit to incentivize employers who hire youth. I want to thank Anthony Smith, who's here, who really helped us out with that. That will now go into the process and will be considered, as we consider all tax credits, first for its policy merits and then as it's part of the bucket of tax credits that we deal with. Any discussion? Seeing none, is there any opposition to introducing these LCs as committee bills? Seeing none, so ordered. Okay, colleagues, we have reached the end of this meeting, and again, it was a pleasure for me to listen to Senator Rosenbaum read all those LCs. In so many ways, she leaves us with a legacy. You know, we have this body owes you so much through your work, not only on this committee, but on the Workforce Committee that existed before it, and so many other areas of your work. I can't thank you enough, Senator.
And I would echo that and offer that I feel a sense of guilt, because it occurred to me the other day that I went to the House, and after one session, Senator Rosenbaum left. And then I came to the Senate, and after one session, Senator Rosenbaum is leaving. So whatever I did, I'm sorry.
It speaks to her confidence in you, Senator Johnson.
That's right. And I am not going to get all teary-eyed here, but I do want to say that truly, it sort of reminds me of the Wizard of Oz comment that I think Dorothy made to, was it the Cowardly Lion, about I'll miss you most of all. This committee, among many, many peak experiences that I've had in my almost 18 years now, has truly been a highlight of my legislative career, and being able to work with you, Mr. Chair, with Senator Gelser, and the entire body on issues like STEM, on paid sick days, on the minimum wage, and a host of other things that have been accomplished that have made life so much better for Oregonians across the state in every county. I am proud to have been part of it. I'm really excited to see what comes next.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I do want to say, just in closing, since it's the final meeting of this interim task force, this interim committee, we've been so well served to have Jan Nordlund as our committee administrator. I think anybody who's worked with her knows that she's one of the stars of this building, and we have been very fortunate.
Thank you.
And I can say no more that's better than that. So with that, we are adjourned. With that, we are adjourned.